making $130,000 a year might reasonably expect to do. The hell of it was, without the roughly $55,000 a year Betty got from the securities her mother left her, they would have had to drastically lower their standard of living, which wasn't all that great to start with. As for how he was going to pay for the $45,000 in legal fees he had already run up trying to fend off Syria, he had no idea whatsoever. And there was a $400-an-hour deposition coming up. The computer screens beyond all the glass walls of the 49th floor glowed and flared and popped out into CD-ROM patterns, and the little phosphorescent lines were skittering from left to right, when a burst of He-Man gullet laughter brought him back into this room, Commander Harry's command post. Harry and Shellnut and Shanks and the boys were shaking with the mirth of their hearty wit and slapping their gaping manly thighs, and Peepgas wondered how on earth it had ever turned out this way. He was smarter than all the talent in this room put together. Then why had he taken such an unadventurous route at the bank? There was only one organizational chart at Planner's Bank, but there were two kinds of officers. There were line officers, and there were staff officers. The line officers were those who generated new business or otherwise created income for the bank. They were involved in marketing, such as originating big loans to entrepreneurs like Charlie Croker, or in investment banking or novel retail strategies, or workouts like Harry. They were the officers Arthur Lamprey and the rest of them here on the 49th floor were referring to when they used that grand-sounding term, bankers. Only a line officer was a real banker. A staff officer wasn't. A staff officer was something else. And there you had Raymond Peepgas. What was he, actually? What was any senior loan officer? He was a referee, a monitor. He was supposed to monitor big loans to make sure they stayed within prudent boundaries. Prudent? It had been a struggle even to be prudent. In the 1980s, prudent hadn't stood a chance, nor in the late 1990s. The boom was on, and the banking business had caught fire, and a wonderful, giddy madness was in the air. The line officers from marketing were pushing through loans, their big sales, with a pell-mell abandon. If you were a referee who insisted on detecting the madness and blowing your whistle, they just ran right over you, laughed at you, made you feel timid and old-fashioned. Like every other senior credit officer, Peepgas had signed off on tens of millions of dollars' worth of loans with self-destruct written all over them, including Charlie Croker's, rather than try to stand in the way of the stampede. But to tell the truth, that explanation, sad as it was, wasn't the whole story. In fact, he had been swept up in the madness himself. Like many another bank officer, he had started getting a euphoric lift out of being part of the grand schemes and imperial visions of the Charlie Crokers of the world. John Sycamore may have been the high-flying line officer who had brought Croker to the bank and made the big sales, but Sycamore had had to come to him, Peepgas, for approval. And he, too, had become an advocate of this infinitely vital and charming backcountry boy, this risk-taker with a grand vision and an infallible touch. It had reached the point where he had become convinced that Croker had more than talent, know-how, and drive, that Croker also had a certain magical power that enabled him to pull off the impossible. And he, Peepgas, was somehow his partner. Croker and Peepgas, riding before the wind on the great sea of money. Instinctively, gloomily, he shook his head at the very thought. There was no denying it. Back then, in the palmy days, he had loved being around Charlie Croker. He was the one who had introduced Croker to Serena, or indirectly he had. In Planner's Bank's private banking department, there had been a line officer named Francis Geistman, known, sotto voce, among the boys as the Ice Princess, of whom Shanks had once said, "She's the only banker in Atlanta who can cut your nuts off and give you a hard-on at the same time." The Ice Princess had dreamed up a new marketing strategy called the Art Investment Seminars. The art market in New York had picked itself up off the floor and was surging again, and Francis Geistman got the bright idea of luring big clients into the bank by offering to instruct them in the arcana of this hot and glamorous New York-style form of investment. Businessmen in Atlanta liked to affect indifference to New York and its fashions, but they also liked to show the world that they moved on just as fast a track as anybody else. And the lure? Here the Ice Princess, who was from New York, had demonstrated her sexual genius. As instructors, she hired recent graduates of the New York University Institute of Fine Arts. The institute seemed to graduate nothing but young, gorgeous, socially connected girls with boarding school accents and tender, loamy loins and legs that drove rich men wild. They matriculated in the art investment seminars in droves. The girls cooed to them about Bruegel the Elder and Fischel the Younger, and about short and long-term auction variables. The courses were conducted, covertly, in conjunction with Gilray's, the New York auction house. The bank lent money to its smitten seminarians and steered them to Gilray's to buy art and sell it, and took commissions from Gilray's going and coming, and set them up with deluxe VIP art tours of New York while they were at it, and then moved in on them to get all their banking business, personal and corporate. There were so many stories floating around about the Ice Princess and her art geishas, Peepgas had dropped in on a few classes, and became as besotted as the worsted-suited marks themselves. Art. He tried to come on to one of the instructors, a little brunette named Jenny, and then another, a willowy redhead named Amy Phipps Phelps. Insofar as he could afford it, he became an habitué of the art world, going to the big gallery and museum openings in Atlanta, including fundraising dinners at the High Museum, which he couldn't afford. He wangled introductions to collectors and museum trustees, anything to get into the merry swim of art's sex, money, and glamour. He didn't get very far with Jenny and Amy. The geishas, if they wanted to fraternize, didn't have to settle for a Planner's Bank staff officer making a pitiable $130,000 a year. There were far, far bigger fish right there in front of them at the bank, at the art seminars. Charlie Croker, for a start. It was Peepgas who had persuaded Croker to take a class and get the feel of this hot new investment opportunity. Croker had found the class a bore and a joke. He was interested in narrative art of men in action, by N.C. Wyeth, Howard Pyle, Frederick Remington, and Winslow Homer. And that was about it. But he found the instructor, Miss Serena Sharp, all he could ask for. Serena was bright and provocatively sarcastic. She had such a perfect young body, such loosely sprung hips, that even in a simple black mini-dress, her professional costume, she managed to look naked. Croker never went near the art investment seminars again, but he went after Serena Sharp and divorced his wife of 29 years and married her. Peepgas was amazed, mostly by the fact that the big tycoon had the nerve to shuck his old wife after all that time, just like that. He couldn't have imagined summoning up the fortitude to leave Betty. Nevertheless, the great sexual itch of the 1980s had been spread to Raymond Peepgas. And then he had met Syria.
What'll he do next?
It was Shanks's voice, in such a high-pitched whine that it cut right through the morose shell of his thoughts. Evidently he was talking to Harry, because Harry said,
"Oh, that's easy. He'll try to hide the airplanes."
"That's a safe fucking bet," said Shellnut. An ordinary human being can't imagine how tightly a shithead bonds with his airplanes, said Harry.
Yeah, said Shellnut. A shithead like Croker never heard of frequent flyer miles or standing still beside an X-ray box while some rent-a-guard making $7.50 an hour runs a Geiger counter up your inseam. Remember that shithead from Cybermax, Harry? Duber was his name, or something like that.
Yeah.
Fucking Hoople sells his King Air, he claims. Turns out he sold it to his sister-in-law for a piece of paper.
What's a Hoople? Asked Shanks.
10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag, said Shellnut. So now every time he has to fly in here to see us, he has his fucking pilot fly the plane to PDK. He has a limo waiting to drive him in on the Buford Highway to downtown, and then he gets a taxi to bring him here. So if anybody sees him arrive, he's getting out of a jelly bean driven by some guy named Jameed.
What's a jelly bean? Asked Friedman.
Oh, you know, a Chevrolet Caprice. All the taxis are Chevrolet Caprices, and they all look like jelly beans.
It was worse than that, said Harry. Fucking guy, while he's flying here from Cincinnati, he calls his secretary and tells her to look up the airline schedules and inform him as to what flight he's supposed to be on right now, and which one he's going back on, in case anybody asks. The dick brain, if he spent half as much time tending to business as he did worrying about his phantom itineraries, we might have gotten out of that one alive.
He gestured toward the Cybermax artificial heart up on the magnificent étagère.
What that shithead needed was a left hemispherectomy.
And a vibram scrotum, said Shellnut.
Well, what do you figure our chances are of coming out of Croker Global alive? Asked Friedman.
He didn't ask it of Peepgas, however, as Peepgas was quick to note, but of Harry.
In the current market, said Harry. You want my honest opinion?
Terrible.
I'd love to foreclose on that big shithead. Love to. They call up here 2 months ago and say they've run into a situation. That's such pure shithead stuff. We've run into a situation. That always means the same thing. They can't make the next interest payment, let alone pay back principal. We've run into a situation.
Disgust dripped from the words.
Well, we don't have a situation. We got a problem. A real nutmasher. We got a pile of commercial real estate here that's leaking money all over the place. And we got 17 wholesale food warehouses operating at a loss. The trouble is, you can't just turn these places off and put locks on them and wait for a change in the economic cycle and then sell them. The buildings have tenants with leases. Lousy leases, and not enough of them, but leases. And you close down a wholesale food operation, and it just dies on you. But if you try to keep it open when it's losing money, it's like opening a vein and hemorrhaging. The idea of taking over and running a bunch of buildings and a chain of food warehouses is not going to put any stars on your shoulder boards on this floor.
Harry twirled his left forefinger in the air to take in the entire 49th floor, meaning Arthur Lomprey and the rest of the top brass.
And there's another thing. If we commence foreclosure proceedings against Croker, then suddenly we got a $500 million loss on the books. Right now those loans are posted as a $500 million asset. A $500 million loss would make a lot of people. It would not look good.
He paused, pursed his lips, and looked around the room significantly.
A $500 million, he said, and then began nodding his head, as if to say, "You get the picture."
"The hell of it is," said Shellnut,
Some of these properties are basically sound, or they would be if you could...
"'Jesus Christ, Jack,' said Shanks. "'You sound just like Croker.'
"'Well, I never said he was wrong, did I? "'All I said was he's a worthless, useless, lying, conniving ball of shit "'who boffs stewardesses on his G5 with our money.'
"'Oh,' said Shanks. "'I don't know how I ever got the idea you thought he was wrong.'
No, I mean you look at some of those early projects he did, like Buckingham Square, Wembley Mall, Phoenix Center. There's nothing wrong with the cost basis. They're just overburdened with debt.
But this last fiasco, Croker Concourse, that fucking building must have come out to $1,000 a foot. There's no way you could make that back, period, much less make a profit and service your debt. If it cost exactly half of what it actually cost, fine. You'd be in good shape. But this way, you could keep at least to capacity for 30 years and still never get your money back. How the hell these goddamned loans ever went through, I don't know.
Then he added hurriedly, as if to spare Peepgas any embarrassment,
Johnny Sycamore was out of control there toward the end.
Shank said, Well, as Lenin once said,
Harry broke in.
Lenin had it easy. He didn't have to clean up after a shithead like Charlie Croker.
Shanks, persevering.
As Lenin once said,
Friedman broke in and said to Harry,
I say we unload the shit as fast as we can and take the loss. There's bankrupt property beginning to flood the market, and that's going to drive all the prices down. The longer we dick around with this property, the less we're going to get for it.
Shanks said,
As Lenin once said,
Harry broke in,
like I said, I'd love to foreclose on that shithead, but we'd look so goddamned bad.
Raymond Peepgas was only halfway paying attention, or rather, he was thinking about the $500 million shithead from an entirely different perspective. The bank might end up ruining Croker, wiping him out utterly, or it might not. The game had not yet been played out. But one thing the bank couldn't change. The bank couldn't change history. There was no rewriting the fact that Charlie Croker was a man who had come from out of nowhere and built up an empire. The empire might crumble and disappear. But so what? So did Napoleon's. Who does the world remember and respect, Napoleon or Joseph Dominique Louis, his treasury minister? Peepgas had looked it up. Who kept his nose clean and retired in 1815 on a pension. He, Peepgas, had gone to the Harvard Business School, whereas Croker couldn't have gotten into Harvard on a bet. But Croker had something that Monsieur Raymond Peepgas did not possess, or rather something he had never been willing to let off the leash. A certain red dog. That was the way he suddenly thought of it. As a red dog, you had to be willing to let off the leash. He could see that wild red dog. It had a chain around its neck, but the chain was broken. It was a red bull terrier with its forehead in a dreadful frown, and its lower incisors bared and thrust forward. Every man had that red dog inside him, but only real men dared let him loose.
Shanks said, As Trotsky once said,
Shelnut broke in.
Trotsky, what happened to Lenin?
Nobody wanted to hear about Lenin, you bunch of anti-intellectual fucks.
Okay, said Shelnut, what did Trotsky say?
He said you don't have to believe in the trolley company to let it take you where you want to go.
Trotsky said that? That's pretty funny. I don't know what the fuck it has to do with anything, but I like it. And incidentally, you need a very long vacation, Shanks.
Harry's squadron cracked up with another macho burst from the gullet, a deep red laugh. That did it somehow. You don't have to believe in the trolley company to let it take you where you want to go. The trolley company. Peepgas could feel, actually feel, some terribly significant synaptic experience in his brain. And he could see, actually see, as if it were some grainy diagram, the outlines of a theory, a concept, a strategy. It would be illegal. He did not yet know exactly why, but that much he could sense with the sort of visceral rush that precedes logic in the case of dreadfully exciting prospects. It would require secrecy, an intimate knowledge of banking procedures, resourceful confederates, the stealth of a cat, the heart of a thief. Strangely, and he was well aware of the strangeness of it, in that moment of revelation he felt that he, Raymond Peepgas, the star Harvard MBA, who had been so cautious that he had chosen banking as a career, he suddenly felt that he had all it took, even the stealth, even the heart. And in that moment his heart began to pound, bang away beneath his breastbone, so frightened and exhilarated was he by what he could see taking shape in his thoughts. If Croker could be forced to hand over Croker Concourse to the bank, hand over the deed in lieu of foreclosure was the term, so that there would be no foreclosure process and therefore no auction, and if the bank could be persuaded to unload the building quietly, for a fraction of its cost, as Friedman was already urging Harry to do, and if a syndicate could be formed to take it off their hands, and if he, Peepgas, were the one who put the syndicate together, without anyone at Planner's Bank knowing, he would crush Charlie Croker, mash his nuts for him, to use Harry's oh-so-graphic way of putting things, and come away from it with untold millions. That was the phrase that actually popped into his head. Untold millions. Untold was the word, all right. Couldn't tell a soul about it. Christ almighty, was it really possible? "Hey, Ray, you look like a happy fella." It was Harry himself. Until he heard that grating, rasping voice, he hadn't realized that a smile had crept across his face. Now he was back in this room. The whole squadron, team saddlebags, was staring at him. Beyond the glass wall, beyond many layers of glass walls, the endless rivulets of a world awash with money streamed across the computer screens with their sickly diode glares. "Oh," he said, "I was just thinking of something Croker once said in that fucking interview in Atlanta Magazine." "Exercise regimen," he said. "I'm from down in southwest Georgia, down below the net line, and if you come down here and ask anybody about a exercise regimen, they won't know what the hell you're talking about. On the other hand, when I need some firewood, I start with a tree." "Jesus Christ, that son of a bitch is so full of shit, and he has dicked around with us so badly. I say we go after every piece of collateral he's got on that list, starting with the airplanes and that ridiculous goddamned plantation of his, which he thinks is fucking Terra, and that house he's living in Buckhead, which he no doubt bought with our money, too. If he's such a down-home hero, if he's such a son of the South Georgia sod, then just let him start over where his mouth is. Let's just let him start over, with his bare ass and an axe and a tree." Nobody else in the room said a word. They just kept staring. They couldn't believe the evidence of their own senses. None of them had ever heard Ray Peepgas use the word fucking before, much less any such terms as bare ass and full of shit. None had ever heard him mimic the mighty Charlie Croker, or for that matter, anyone else. None had ever heard him suggest going after some shithead with fangs bared, like the saber-toothed tiger he was not. And certainly none had ever seen him with the sort of malevolent grin he was sporting at this moment. What the hell had gotten into old Ray? Oh, he knew very well what they were thinking. But then there was no way any of them could have possibly known that Raymond Peepgas had just slipped his red dog off the leash and let him out for the first romp of his life.
To a man of 60, like Charlie Croker, one of the grimmest reminders of the Reaper's approach comes when his doctors, the people who have attended to his body for decades, begin retiring on him, or dying on him, or both. The orthopedist who had looked after Charlie's right knee since he first injured it in a game against Auburn, Archibald Turner, had retired 2 years ago and died of a heart attack 1 year ago. Arch Turner's practice had included many of the best bones in Buckhead. Now his two young associates, Emery Knuckles, rhymed with Buckles, and Douglas Ray, had inherited all those excellent golden bones, and M.O. Knuckles became the new tender of Charlie's aching knee joint. At this moment, Charlie was sitting on the edge of an examination table, minus his pants and shoes, watching M.O. Knuckles's peculiar mouth as it said, "Look, Charlie, a knee replacement is not a medical decision, not in the sense of your general health. It's a question of how much pain you can stand without having it replaced. There's only one person who can answer that question." He waited several portentous heartbeats before adding, "And that's you." Oh, brother. Charlie hated the condescension that inevitably found its way into the young man's voice. M.O. was about 40, a full generation younger than Charlie, and yet he had called him Charlie right from day one. He insisted on being called M.O., a nickname that reminded Charlie of a motor oil or a laxative. He would have preferred to have called him a curt, formal Dr. Knuckles. But M.O. was a member of the driving club, and at the club he couldn't very well be saying hello to him and introducing him as Dr. Knuckles. M.O. Knuckles had fast-receding curly black hair and a crinkly black beard that was carefully trimmed, so that it created an oval that ran from his nose to his chin, and was at no place more than half an inch wider than his lips. The explanation that this small, grisly oval had been designed to fit beneath the standard face mask during surgery was one Charlie had not sought and could have done without. Worst of all were his lips and his curiously tiny teeth. The lips were incredibly red. They curved like a woman's. It was somehow disgusting to watch him speak with this woman's mouth of his, set in the middle of such a finically shaped oval of black shag. "Okay," said Charlie. "How long are you laid up if you have a knee replaced?" "That varies," said the red lips, "but usually you're in the hospital 5 days to a week. But now I don't want to mislead you. Full recovery can take as long as 6 weeks. The most difficult part of the whole thing is post-op. You have to undergo therapy immediately to keep the muscles, tendons, and ligaments from stiffening up, and there's a fair amount of pain involved. I've never seen an operation that was a failure in and of itself. The only failures I've seen have been cases where the patient couldn't take the pain of keeping the joint flexible, and even that's been very seldom, certainly in my experience." "In my experience? And how much is that, in God's name? You're a kid, a calf, a baby. In my experience, indeed." And in that moment a flash of revelation hit Charlie. It wasn't just Arch Turner's departure from this globe that made Charlie feel old. It was the realization that there were all these kids out there, these children, ready and more than willing to do the job. It got harder and harder to feel indispensable at age 60. "Well, I'll think it over," said Charlie. He never said anything like, "I'll think it over, M.O." He was damned if he'd use this red-lipped mooncalf's oily nickname if he didn't have to. Chapter 11. "This is not right." An accident in the Caldecott Tunnel on Route 24 had caused a terrific backup, so that Conrad arrived in downtown Oakland barely 5 minutes before his 10 a.m. appointment. Where could he park the Hyundai? Where could he park it? Where? He was frantic. Just as his mom and dad had never thought twice about letting appointments go with the flow, he was obsessive about keeping them. Where could he park? There. There. A block and a half from the East Bay Insurance Building, where the Contempo Time offices were located. He spotted a space just this side of a strip of curbing painted red, with a fire hydrant in the middle of it. Only a car as small as the Hyundai could have squeezed into the legal space remaining, and even then only by backing up against the bumper of a big Chevrolet Suburban. As soon as he walked into the premises of Contempo Time, he realized that this appointment of his was in fact only some sort of vague traffic slot. 20 or 30 people, a couple of them middle-aged white men in coats and ties, sat in rows of school-style desk chairs in a bare, spare reception area, filling out forms and waiting to be assigned to an interviewer. The room was lit by banks of fluorescent tubes, which kept blinking, so that the entire place seemed to be suffering from a colossal tick. Conrad picked up the forms from a receptionist and sat down in one of the rows of desk chairs and joined the herd. Acceding, however bitterly, to Mrs. Otey's urgings, he had worn a long-sleeved white shirt, a necktie, his only jacket, which was a single-breasted navy blazer he had bought at Roos Atkins in Walnut Creek 2 years before, and a pair of gray worsted pants, which were the only wool pants he possessed. The jacket was now too tight, and he could no longer button the shirt at the neck, causing the tie to look unkempt. And his hands, his laborer's hands, the subject of Mrs. Otey's insulting admonition, extended too far beyond the shirt cuff and the jacket sleeves. Nevertheless, he was glad he had worn this, his only dress-up outfit. Long after he had completed the forms, he sat there in the dismal, blinking, tick-afflicted ranks of school chairs, listening to the hum and clatter of electric typewriters in a maze of cubicles that stretched on beyond the reception area, idly wondering, why typewriters? Since Contempo Time's advertisements stressed word processor skills. By and by he was summoned back to the reception desk and introduced to a girl named Carol, who was no older than he was, a sunny creature with milky white skin and bouncy reddish-blonde hair, a bit plump, but with a perfect dimple in her chin, and absolutely marvelous dimples in her cheeks when she smiled, which was constantly. She showed him into a cubicle with 4-foot-high particle board walls, a so-called workstation. There was barely room for the furniture, which consisted of 2 low-backed gray fiberglass chairs and a desk, upon which rested a big IBM Selectric typewriter. The chattering rat-tat-tat of other electric typewriters poured in from cubicles all around. When the girl twisted her body to sit down, her little skirt gripped the full curve of her thigh. She had such a libidinous presence. Confused, a tingle, blushing, Conrad smiled at her. She smiled back, so frankly. She looked straight into his eyes, so warmly. Then she began studying the forms he had filled out. After a bit, she said, "Have you ever done any office work before, any word processing?" "No, but I studied it in college. I took a course in it, 2 semesters. She went over the forms some more. "Well, that's the main thing, being able to use the computer. That and being able to spell." A rogue notion ran through his mind. What if he asked her out for coffee or something? Or for lunch? It would soon be lunchtime, and he had brought a little over $100 with him. He shouldn't spend so much as a nickel on lunch in downtown Oakland, but if he caught on with Contempo Time, or it looked like it was a sure thing at least. Not a big lunch, just something quick. He deserved, after everything he—it would do him good.
and besides...
The girl got down to the matter of the test. It was in two parts, a written test concerning the use of a word processor and a typing test. She handed him a clipboard with the written test on it, produced a little white plastic kitchen timer, set it for 15 minutes, and placed it on the desk.
"Good luck," she said as she left the cubicle. "I'll be back. There isn't much to it."
And in fact, there wasn't much to it, especially since the answers were multiple choice. How do you delete two lines within a paragraph? How do you create a second copy? To save material, what do you do? He had finished long before the bell on the timer went off. He scored 100. To set up the typing test, the girl had to lean over him and place some written material on the little stenographic easel beside the IBM Selectric. The warmth of her body set loose the most delicious perfume. Conrad was a tingle all over again. She remained bent over, supporting herself with her hands on her knees. Her face was right beside his.
"Now, this time," she said, "when I say go, you start typing, starting right here."
She pointed to the beginning of the paragraph at the top of the page on the easel.
"You just keep on typing until I tell you to stop. You'll have 5 minutes, okay? It's not a big deal. 30 words a minute qualifies. I'm sure you can do that."
"I was up to 85 words a minute when I took the course at Mount Diablo," said Conrad. "But I haven't done this for a while, so don't expect any world records."
85? I don't think I ever tested anybody who could do 85.
She made a little laughing sound deep in her throat as she said it, and Conrad thought he could feel the warmth of her cheek, although in fact her cheek was 6 or 8 inches away. He had a new rogue urge, to hold her face in his hands and kiss her. Instead, he turned his face toward hers and said, "Do you mind if I ask you something?" Now she turned toward him. Her face was so close to his, he saw 3 eyes and many dimples.
So sunny, so frisky,
so full of rude, pink animal health. He felt intoxicated.
"Go ahead," she said.
His cheeks were turning crimson.
Did he dare? Could he possibly?
Don't be crazy. So he stuck to his question.
"Why is the typing test? Why do you give it on a typewriter? Won't we be using computers?" "Oh, sure," she said.
She didn't pull her head back at all. She seemed to be beaming at him. He could detect a faint, sweet aroma of spearmint on her breath. He loved it. He loved everything about her.
"But for the test, all we want to see is how well you type, how fast you are, and how accurate you are. On a computer, you can go back and delete your mistakes, and that way we can't tell how accurate you really are."
She pushed a little ribbed wheel on the keyboard, and the big Selectric came humming to life in a delicious cloud of perfume and spearmint. Then she stood up and turned the chunky hand on the timer once more.
"You have 5 minutes," she said. "Just type as much as you can, as accurately as you can, before I come back. Okay? Ready? Go."
She set the timer down on the little desk.
"Good luck."
A wonderful smile. The most wonderful smile in the world. Then she withdrew from the cubicle. Conrad took a deep breath and placed his fingers on the keyboard in the standard touch-typing position. The timer was already ticking away. At the top of the page was a paragraph that began, "This ratio can be easily derived by comparing the real inflation-adjusted capital fueling the two most recent retail electronics booms, 1971-75 and 1983-87. Figures 4 through 6. The amount of real capital in the most recent period was $736.1 billion as compared with..." He concentrated on the first words, "This ratio can," and started typing. The Selectric's little letter ball jumped about madly and spat out a terrific rat-a-tat upon the paper. He knew immediately that something had gone wrong. He stared. Instead of "this," he had somehow typed R-H-H-H-O-D-D. Instead of the capital T, the I, and the S, he had hit the letters next to them, the capital R, the O, and the D. He had managed to hit the H, but he had pressed it down too heavily and too long, causing it to repeat. He was baffled and appalled. How could that have happened? He would have to start over. He looked about for another sheet of typing paper, but there was none. Then her words came back to him. They wanted a true record of how accurate, or inaccurate, you were. He scrolled the paper up a few lines and started over. Another clattering rat-a-tat. He inspected his handiwork. "This rat-hip," instead of "this ratio." He had overlapped the P when he tried to strike the O. Should he start over again? No time. So he backspaced and typed an O over the P. Didn't help much. Looked like an O with a tail. Then he realized what the problem was. His hands. His fingers were now so much wider and heavier and stronger. From working in the warehouse, he was constantly overlapping adjoining keys or else striking them too hard, causing the letters to repeat. He had lost the touch in his own fingers. Two grotesque, muscle-bound strangers, his hands were. My own hands! He stared at them as if he had never seen them before. The ticking of the timer seemed dreadfully loud. A minute had gone by, and he had produced a grand total of a dozen words, most of them mangled. Gingerly he placed his fingertips back on the keyboard, hoping against hope that it would all come back to him. It had to. He stared at the text. Most recent retail. Rat-a-tat-a-tat. And he had written, comma PST, resempt, RWTSIL. A burning panic. These hands of which he had been so proud just a few hours ago, as he stared into the bathroom mirror, they were the paws of a dumb animal, of a beast of burden. He couldn't believe it. And all the while the humming of the IBM Selectric grew louder and louder. Okay, big boy, produce. I'm ready, I'm humming, I'm waiting. What about you? And the timer went tick, 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 tick. He plunged on, trying to batter his way through the text, since nothing else seemed to work, typing right on top of misstruck letters, X-ing out the totally hopeless mistakes and the repeats, letting the hair-trigger keys rat-a-tat-a-tat amok. Just get through it, that was the main thing. In no time, ding, the timer bell went off, and the girl, Carol, was in the entryway to the cubicle. Conrad stared at the piece of paper. Far from having produced the minimum of 150 words in 5 minutes, he wasn't sure he had produced 90. With all the X's, typeovers, repeats, and false starts, the tight little single-spaced patch of words looked like something small and black that had been run over on a highway.
"Well," said the girl brightly, "how'd it go?"
Conrad was speechless. All he could do was shake his head. Her eyes shifted to the page.
"What happened?"
"I don't know," said Conrad. He lifted his hands, and was suddenly mortified that she might notice their size. He hid them in his lap.
"I just couldn't. I guess it's been so long. I don't know."
In a low, confidential tone, she said,
"Well, do you want to try it again? I'm not supposed to, but I can give you another sheet of paper, and we'll do it over."
"Thanks, but it's no use. I don't know what's wrong."
"Why don't you go home and practice some and then come back? You want to? If you call ahead and let me know when you're coming, I can get the desk to assign you to me. We're not supposed to do that either, but I'll do it.
She gave him a sympathetic smile.
It's just... He couldn't complete the sentence.
I'll try, he said in a hopeless tone. He thanked her and left without another word. On the elevator, he held his hands up before his face. What had he turned into? The longer he stared at them, the bigger they seemed to become. My own hands. And she had tried to give him everything, on a platter. He could still see her smile, her dimples, the swell of her breasts, the curve of her thighs. The most shaming part of it was that the ever-smirking Arda Oti had been right, more so than she could have ever even guessed. Thoughts of Jill and her mother possessed him as he walked down the sidewalk heading for his car. It was a bright, sparkling noontime, a fact that couldn't have interested him less. What would they say when he told them? What would they think? Or did he have to tell them? Why couldn't he just say he had had the interview and was waiting to hear back? Scuffling along the sidewalk, his head down, he scarcely even noticed the knot of idlers and gawkers who had gathered near a truck until he was almost upon them. It was a high-riding flatbed truck painted a hot yellow-green and embellished with swash lettering and pinstriping and gleaming chrome. A sunburnt man wearing a cowboy hat and a leather vest appeared, a regular giant, 250 pounds if he was an ounce. The sleeves of his shirt had been cut off at the shoulders, revealing his huge, fleshy arms. He walked to the front of the truck, stepped up on a chrome running board, opened the door, leaned inside the cab, emerged with a metal rod of some kind, and returned to the rear. It occurred to Conrad, with a start, that whatever was going on, it was in the red zone in front of where he had parked the Hyundai. The gawkers blocked his view. He hurried forward and joined them. He found himself staring at the broad beam of the giant in the cowboy hat, who was leaning over, attaching a tow chain to a car that had both front wheels up on the curb, right in the middle of the red zone, barely a foot from the fire hydrant. And in that instant Conrad realized it was his car, his little Hyundai Excel, in the middle of the red zone, up on the curb. Impossible! And yet there it was. There was a ticket under the windshield wiper. Standing on the sidewalk, right beside the car, following the tow truck operator's progress, was a meter maid, easily identifiable by her uniform, a short-sleeved, powder-blue shirt and navy-blue pants. She was probably in early middle age, so stout that the flesh of her upper arms stretched the hems of her sleeves. She held a walkie-talkie radio up to her mouth. She had a terrific set of Chinese red press-on nails on her fingers. Conrad approached from the side. He was scarcely 18 inches from her, but she didn't give him so much as a flicker of an eye. "Excuse me," he said. No response. Much louder. "Excuse me!" The walkie-talkie still at her ear, she cut him a glance that said, "Don't bother me." "Miss," said Conrad. She gave him a withering look and said, "Can't you see I'm transmitting?" The terribly official-sounding word, transmitting, brought him up short, and he turned toward the tow truck driver. By now the big man had secured the tow chain beneath the Hyundai and was standing up, and you could see just how enormous he really was. He was a mountain of flesh with the sun-beaten, lard-grilled look of a roustabout, clear down to the immense ring of keys hanging from a belt loop beneath the bulge of his belly on one side of his jeans, and the cluster of novelty key fobs on the other. A tiny wrench, a disposable butane lighter, a pair of dice, a plastic figurine of Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse doing the tango, a miniature dueling pistol, and a little silvery skull with fangs instead of eye teeth. Conrad jumped between the fire hydrant and the fender of the Hyundai and over the tow chain and rushed up to him.
"Hey, sir! This is my car! What are you doing?"
Scarcely looking at him, not even pausing, the giant said, "Towing it out of the red zone." He said it in a bored way that made it clear he had said the same thing, or something very close to it, 1,000 times before, to 1,000 other frantic, befuddled, and above all helpless automobile owners. He was now heading for the driver's side front door with the shaft of metal he had taken from the truck. It was a length of spring steel. Conrad recognized it immediately. It was a device known as a Slim Jim, used to slip through the window seals of locked cars to release the lock mechanisms from the inside.
"Wait a minute! Please!"
But the giant was already inserting the Slim Jim between the glass and the frame.
"You're going to break the glass! I've got the keys right here! I can open the door!"
"Nobody's breaking any glass," said the giant in the same bored voice, without looking at him. In no time he had sprung the lock, opened the door, and was reaching inside, doing something with the steering wheel.
"Please," said Conrad, "it's my car. I've got the keys. I can move it."
The giant didn't even look at him. Utterly nonplussed, Conrad swung back toward the sidewalk to appeal to the meter maid. She wasn't looking at him either. She was writing something in her summons book. By now the knot of gawkers had grown into a real crowd. They were revved up, ready for some action, eager for the Beano, now that the hapless owner of the automobile had materialized and was acting suitably dismayed, frightened, anguished, and frustrated. This time Conrad yelled at the meter maid.
"Hey, miss!"
She looked up, and he jumped back over the tow chain and went straight to her.
"Please, you gotta tell me what's going on. This is my car!"
She began studying the summons pad and gestured toward the Hyundai without looking at Conrad. "Car's in the red zone, and up on the sidewalk." Conrad raised his hands in frustration.
"But I didn't park in the red zone, I swear! Look, miss, listen, I was all the way back there, on the other side of the line."
"Well, exactly the way it's sittin' right now, that's exactly the way it was sittin' when I called the dispatcher." She said this in a reasonable enough tone, but it inspired a couple of uh-huhs and he-he's among the gawkers, and she became aware she had an audience. So she added, "And I never seen a car drive itself into a red zone yet."
"Whoo-ee,"
said one of the gawkers, and another said, "Oh, yeah," all in the eternal spirit of "let's you and him fight."
"Look, miss," said Conrad.
He struggled to find the right words, the compelling logic.
"I'm telling you, I didn't park in the red zone. Honest. And even if I did, would I put my front wheels up on the curb? Would that make any sense?"
The woman delivered a contralto chuckle deep in her throat and said, "They don't pay me enough to make sense out of what the drivers do in this town. Couldn't pay me enough to do that." This brought such an appreciative round of uh-huhs and he-he-he's and woo-wee's, the big woman felt uplifted, emboldened. Usually street crowds were against the meter maid, but she had won this bunch over with rhetorical brilliance, and so she headed for new heights. "My job is to keep cars from parking in the wrong place and getting them out of there when they do, and that car right there is parked in about as wrong a place as you can get. That's a red zone, and that's a fire hydrant, and that's a sidewalk, and that's a tow truck."
"Woo-wee! Oh, yeah, that's a tow truck!"
Conrad was dumbstruck. In the next moment he realized what had happened. To squeeze into the small space on the legal side of the red zone, he had backed his car up against the bumper of the Chevrolet Suburban behind him. The driver of the Suburban had returned, and, finding himself hemmed in, had bulldozed his way out by pushing the little Hyundai forward along the pavement. Conrad must have left his wheels turned toward the curb, so that the sheer brute force of the Suburban had shoved the Hyundai all the way up onto the sidewalk.
"But this isn't right," said Conrad. "The car behind me must have pushed my car where it is. Why else would it be up on the curb?"
His vehemence caused the meter maid to withdraw a little. She sighed, cast her eyes down, and shook her head. "I don't know nothing about another car. Anyway, can't do nothing about it now."
"But why not?" said Conrad. "Please, I'm right here. It's my car. I've got the keys. I'll take the car out of the red zone."
To indicate how compellingly logical his solution was, as compared to the official one now in progress, he threw his hands up in front of his shoulders in the gesture that says, "It's so obvious only a fool could fail to see it." This did not help his case. With a bit of a growl, the meter maid pinned her eyes on her summons book and said, "It's too late. Already wrote it up and called the dispatcher. Once it's written up, that's it."
"Well, go ahead and give me the ticket, but let me take my car. I've got to have my car."
"I told you it's too late. Once the summons is made out and the dispatcher's notified and the tow's hooked up, then it's a tow. And ain't nothing nobody can do about it once it's a tow."
"But this is not right," said Conrad.
"Hoo-wee! Ooh-hoo-hoo-hoo! A tow is a tow!"
Conrad looked at the gawkers, whose merry eyes seemed to be saying, "Now what are you going to do?" He looked at the meter maid, who seemed to be reveling in her new role as street entertainer. He looked toward the tow truck driver. But he had disappeared into the cab of the truck and was getting ready to pull the Hyundai up onto the slant of the flatbed.
But this was not right.
On top of everything else, he couldn't lose his car this way. At that moment, the tow truck started up with a great throaty roar, followed by the hideously loud and harsh grinding sound of the winching gear. The gawkers were suddenly quiet, thrilled to see that the drama was approaching its climax. The power, the authority, the mighty truck. Its yellow-green paint job shone from many coats of lacquer in which glittery particles were somehow suspended. Streams of pinstriping swept back from the hood and across the door of the cab. On the door, a rollicking silvery script with a shiny black undershadow proclaimed, 3C Towing, Salvage, and Repair. Conrad stared with his mouth open. Somehow the truck was the mechanical embodiment of the arrogance and imperiousness of the meter maid and the driver themselves. The little Hyundai began to slide up the slant of the flatbed. In no time it was secured, trapped, in the piggyback position, and the truck was lumbering off. All the while the gawkers were watching him. Him, this helpless nonentity, who could do nothing more than stand there with his keys in his hand as they, those with the power, took his car away from him before his very eyes.
My car!
He had not merely been wronged. He had suffered a dreadful, shameful, humiliating defeat, with this bunch of trifling idlers as his audience. He could barely control his voice when he asked the meter maid how much the fine was for parking in a red zone, and what he had to do to get his car back. She answered him in a reasonable and even courteous way, which somehow made it all worse. Her roughshod victory, her humiliation of this young man with his protestations and his this-is-not-rights, her subjugation of Conrad Hensley was so complete, she could now throw him a morsel of civility. All the while he knew he had a still more humiliating audience to deal with. In a broken-down little duet in Pittsburgh, his wife and her mother, they who had already indicted him for worthlessness, hopelessness, joblessness, and the wrong parents, they were now waiting for him and his car. Jill's mother's car was in the shop for repairs, and he was supposed to pick her up when he returned to fetch it. Surely even he, the otherwise hopeless one, could manage a simple thing like returning from Oakland in a timely fashion and taking Mother over to the garage. He dreaded the telephone call he would now have to make. The ordeal began before he actually made it. A telephone. He looked all around on this busy street in downtown Oakland, and there wasn't a telephone to be found. He started walking. 3 blocks he walked before he finally found one. It was the type that required a quarter to initiate a long-distance call. But he didn't have a quarter. In his pocket he had 5 $20 bills, a 5 and 3 ones. The bills, thank God, would be just enough to retrieve the car. According to the meter maid, the fine for parking in a red zone was $30, and the towing fee was another $77. But right now he needed to change one of the dollar bills and get a quarter. But where? He looked all around. Nothing but office buildings and the kind of shops you didn't just walk into and ask for change. He walked some more. Finally, he spotted a candy stand in the lobby of an office building on Broadway. The proprietor, a swarthy man, apparently Asian, didn't even deign to answer his question. He just gave him a dour look and kept pointing to a crudely lettered sign on the candy counter. No change without purchase. In his way, he was as humiliating as the tow truck driver, dealing in a bored, contemptuous manner with a question he had already heard from 1,000 other urban vermin. The cheapest item was a newspaper, the Oakland Tribune, for 50 cents. But by now Conrad was starving, and so instead he bought a Schotter's HDL for high-density lipids, chocolate health nut bar for 60 cents, yielding him the quarter he needed, plus a dime and a nickel in change. This decision he would soon regret, even aside from the fact that the candy bar sliced a thin blade of hypersweetness into his stomach and quelled his hunger for all of 10 minutes. He walked the 3 blocks back to the pay telephone and placed his call to Pittsburgh, collect. The telephone was supposed to return his quarter, but ate it instead. Jill accepted the call. She repeated everything he said, slowly, loudly, so slowly and loudly she seemed to be mocking him. After a few moments he realized it must be for the benefit of her mother. When he reached the part about finding the car up on the sidewalk in a red zone, Jill started saying, "You left it in a red zone? Up on the sidewalk? You left it in a red zone? Up on the sidewalk?" "No, no, no," he protested. He had found it that way upon his return. "In a red zone? On the sidewalk?" Not even the meter maid had been quite so contemptuous. Suddenly she asked him how the job interview had gone. Conrad stammered out a few words to the effect that he might have to take the test again. "Might have to take the test again?" At this he dropped all defenses and circumlocutions and just started telling her what had happened. She cut him off in the middle, as you would anyone who was so predictably hopeless and pathetic that the details of his latest failure simply didn't matter. "Conrad, I want you back here with that car right away. My mother's stranded, I'm stranded, the children are stranded, everybody's stranded until you get in the car and come back here." When he hung up, he felt feverish, as if suffering from some insidious infection, called inevitable failure. It was a good little hike down Broadway to reach the parking violations office at 150 Frank Ogawa Plaza, where you had to go to pay your fines before retrieving a towed vehicle. The meter maid, the giant with the cowboy hat, the gawkers, and now the swarthy man at the candy counter. He felt feverish. In the parking violations office, there was a whole row of windows, but only one was open, and Conrad found himself at the end of a long, ponderous line in another grim, gray-beige room with fluorescent lights. It took him 40 minutes to reach the window, where a gaunt woman, the very embodiment of tried patience, informed him that he owed an additional $30. He was stunned. Stunned!
He didn't have an additional $30. $30 for what?
For parking on a sidewalk. That was in addition to the $30 for parking in a red zone, making a total of $60 in fines he would have to pay in order to get a slip releasing the car from the towing pound. At the pound, he would still have to pay a $77 towing charge, assuming he got there by 7 p.m. Any sort of charge for picking it up? The clerk looked at his ticket. The tow was at 11 a.m. exactly. Then she looked at her watch. If he got there by 7 p.m., he should be all right. He shouldn't have to pay the $50-a-day storage fee. That was a total of $137 he would have to pay out, and all he had was $107.15. Nor was that the end of it. The pound. All along he had assumed that the pound was some municipal facility downtown, near this building. Now he was informed that his car would be at the towing company's own lot. Two companies did the towing for the city. His car had been towed by a new one, 3C Towing, Salvage and Repair. Which was where? On Keeler Avenue, over in East Oakland. Conrad knew only one thing about East Oakland. It was the slums. A cloud rose up his brain stem and filled his head. His car would be deep in the slums, in the domain of a giant roustabout with a cowboy hat. He paid the $60 and left the parking violations office with the release slip, $47.15 in his pocket, a racing heart, and a big problem. How could he get another $29.85? No, he had two problems, three problems, four problems. The tide seemed to rise with every passing second. The only possible way to get the money would be to call Jill again. An appalling prospect in itself. If she had it, she could get it to him. How? Wire it? How was it done? He had never telegraphed anything in his life. Many times when he was a boy, he had gone with his parents to the Western Union office in San Francisco after they had pleaded desperately and wholly mendaciously with their parents or old friends for pity, which meant money in the form of a Western Union money order. He had so botched things, he couldn't even make the call. He had only 15 cents in change. If only he had bought a newspaper instead of the Schotter's HDL Chocolate Health Nut Bar, he would have had 25 cents. Had to have his candy bar, didn't he? He tugged absent-mindedly at his mustache, then set off at a brisk walk, once more looking for some place to break a dollar bill. 2 blocks, 3 blocks, 4 blocks. He could feel, or thought he could feel, his blood pressure rising. His extremities seemed to be gorged with blood. At last, a hole in the wall that sold glassine envelopes, little glass pipes, so-called roach clips, sunglasses, candy, cigarettes, and newspapers. Tenderized, he didn't dare ask for change. He bought an Oakland Tribune for 50 cents. To his consternation, the proprietor, a dour little olive-skinned man with a drooping lip, gave him a 50-cent piece in change.
A 50-cent piece? You couldn't put that in a pay telephone. A 50-cent piece? Hadn't seen one in years. Why now?
Only after repeated entreaties did the man agree to exchange it for 2 quarters. Outside, Conrad threw the newspaper away in a receptacle on the corner. He now had 2 $20 bills, a 5, a 1, 2 quarters, a dime, and a nickel. He started walking again. Over there, a telephone. He deposited a quarter. Nothing. Dead. It was out of order. He couldn't get the quarter back. He jiggled the lever. He pounded the machine with the heel of his hand. A panic rose up in him, and now his extremities seemed to shrink and grow cold. He walked all the way back to the first telephone he had found. His heart was beating much too fast. Gingerly, he deposited his last quarter. and placed another collect call to Jill, and told her the whole sad story. This time her long, deadly silence was worse than anything she could have said. She left the telephone. She returned after what seemed like an eternity. Tonelessly, she delivered the information that, between them, she and her mother had only $23 in cash. Tonelessly, she told him she would now have to spend most of that, probably, to take a taxi all the way out to the bank and then all the way to Western Union, wherever on earth that was. Tonelessly, with a seething restraint, she asked him if he realized how utterly, utterly, and then words failed her. By the time he hung up, his throat felt so constricted he could barely speak. The only good thing that came out of it was that this time the machine at least returned the quarter he had used to initiate the call. So he stood on the street in downtown Oakland, with $46.40 in his pocket, waiting for his wife to chase down $35 in a taxi and call him back. He couldn't budge. He had to stand here and wait by this telephone. Her voice had dripped with insinuation. He had descended to the level of life's hopeless losers. He had lost his job, couldn't pass the simplest employment test imaginable, and now he had gone and lost his car. "No!" poured into his heart. Forlorn, he looked up at the sky. It was a bright, cloudless day, but something had happened. That dazzling light was becoming steadily lower. It had been 2:35 when he hung up with Jill. Now it was 2:55, and the sun was definitely no longer overhead. The day was sinking, sinking, sinking. And if he didn't reach the pound by 7 p.m., he would have to pay a day's storage, which would be still more money he didn't possess. A current of anxiety ran through his solar plexus. It was almost 3:30 when she finally called back. Many crabbed details of the ordeal by taxi, which had cost $22.50, finally the address of the Western Union office where he could go to claim the $35, 1400 Broadway. Thank God, at least he knew where that was. But when he reached 1400 Broadway, it turned out to be not a Western Union office, but a drugstore. Baffled, he started approaching people on the sidewalk. "Excuse me." The first two ignored him as if he were a beggar. But why? He was wearing a coat and tie. Was there now something people could see in his eyes? Had this feverish anxiety he was feeling done something to his face? The next three said they didn't know where it was. He looked at his watch. 3:32. Finally, an old woman walking along Broadway in a royal blue jogging suit and gleaming white sneakers gave him directions. Western Union was 6 blocks away, on Franklin Street. He hurried down Broadway, but where she said it was on Franklin Street, a grocery store. Back onto Broadway he went, frantically querying passers-by, who now began to look at him as if he had room to let upstairs. Finally, a young Asian woman, Korean, Japanese, told him it was inside a check-cashing facility, up that way. So Conrad ran up that way. Sure enough, there was a Western Union window inside the place. It seemed that Western Union was now devoted almost entirely to money orders, and its branches were often located inside of drugstores, grocery stores, all sorts of retail outlets, served by a single computer network. Now, 3:35. By the time he reached Western Union, it was 3:55. Quite a little line of woebegone souls, seeking the services of a lone clerk, a courtly Asian behind a teller's window. One and all seemed to be picking up, sending out, or feverishly waiting for money orders. It was 4:25 by the time he worked his way up to the window and was face to face with the clerk. The final, all-too-perfect note
came when the man asked him the test question, designed to make sure the right person collected the money order. Jill had contrived it, and the question, as it came out in the clerk's curious chirping accent, was,
"What is Jill's father's name? And title?"
Conrad heard himself intoning the very syllables that signified all that distinguishes the higher orders of humanity from Conrad Hensley. Dr. Arnold Oatey. No sooner did the man slip him the $35 through the slot at the base of the window than Conrad realized he should have asked Jill to get him more money, so that he could take a taxi to the car pound. It was now 4:30. He had 2.5 hours to get there. But how? He had only $4.40 to spare. He would have to take a bus. But what bus? From where? Suppose there was no bus that went near the place. So he asked the clerk. The man gave him a funny little smile.
"Oh, I don't know. East Oakland. Ha ha! There I don't travel. However, I can avoid it."
Out on the street again. The light was beginning to fade. It seemed to take forever before he found someone, the manager of a mailbox incorporated service, who knew where the nearest bus stop was. Just the nearest bus